Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll learn about the rise in teen sexting in Wisconsin. A reporter will share her investigation into the phenomenon and some of the unknown consequences.
First, last Friday, Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald laid out a timeline that could make Wisconsin a right-to-work state in a matter of weeks. Under right-to-work legislation, union contracts with employers would not be allowed to require all employees to pay union dues.
The Senate Labor Committee will hold a public hearing on the topic tomorrow, and the Senate will begin debate on Wednesday. The Assembly will take up the legislation next week. Governor Walker has already said he will sign the bill, which would be effective then after his signature.
Republicans appear to have the votes to pass the bill in both the Senate and the Assembly. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald originally said the legislature would hold off until April to debate right to work. This is now being taken up in an extraordinary session.
Last Friday, we spoke with Republican Assembly Representative Chris Kapinga, a supporter of right to work legislation. Now Phil Neuenfeld joins us. He's president of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO, the Union Federation. Phil, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So you are opposed to right-to-work legislation. What is your case against it here in Wisconsin?
Well, when you look at this bill, I mean, there's a number of factors that come into play here. First of all, if you do a comparison to states that have right-to-work versus states that do not, there's a significant income gap where workers in states that have right-to-work laws make less money, have less benefits, and tend to not enjoy retirement security as well as those workers who do live in states where they have stronger collective bargaining agreements. If you start to weaken collective bargaining and the wages and the benefits and all the conditions that go on in union workplaces, that transcends into all workplaces. So the entire middle class is going to have even more downward pressure on their wages, more downward pressure under benefits as a result of this law.
Now, Representative Kapinga, who was on Friday, and other supporters say this is a worker freedom issue. We shouldn't be making an employee pay union dues for the perk of being able to work with the employer they want to work for. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, I think there's several responses to that. One is that under the law, there is no law that forces people to join a union. People can opt to go to employers that don't have unions. And last but not least, I mean, that you have to think about that's the equivalent of people who get services and enjoy certain conditions but decide not to pay their fees or decide not to pay for the service that they receive. That's not acceptable in any other part of society. Why should it be acceptable in the work environment? I'm sure if somebody shows up and says, well, I want to get the wages and the benefits and everything else that this union contract provides for me, I'm sure they're not going to, yeah, I just don't want to pay the dues. I mean, that, you know, that's just not fair to those that are carrying the burden.
So you are, of course, invested in this issue. If this goes through, it could lead to a decline in union membership. Are you just, in effect, protecting the power, the survival of your current union?
Absolutely not. We're working. We've been working for years to grow this movement through collective action, through working with different community coalitions. Once again, take a look at the facts. Take a look at the data. There's two independent studies that show the harsh economic realities of this bill and how it pertains to the entire economy, how it pertains to the entire middle class. This is about everybody. This is about everybody's wages. This is about everybody's benefit. This is about the rights. This is about trying to have some voice in a workplace for workers that so choose to democratically vote to have one. So these are just attacks to erode those sorts of things, push Wisconsin more towards a low road strategy for wages. You know, their argument is we want to do that to be competitive, to bring jobs here. There's no evidence of that. When you look at Oklahoma, since they've gone right to work, they've lost work. We've been able to bring jobs here from right to work states, so it simply doesn't play.
So Wisconsin would be the 25th state to pass some form of what they call right-to-work legislation. Do you have a sense of how this specific legislation in Wisconsin compares to what other states have done? Would you see it as worse, more all-encompassing, better, or somewhere in the middle?
Well, from what we can tell, you have to look at the process by which they're moving it. They're calling an extraordinary session. They don't want to have this bill out there. They don't want to have people understand it. They don't want to have a debate because they know at the end of the day, once people realize what's going on here, they're really going to object to it. They will object to it, but it'll be too late under the rules of which they're trying to move this. This bill is almost word for word a bill that's been produced by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which I think a lot of your listeners realize is an organization that's funded by a lot of corporate right-wing think tanks, and that's what this is. It's their language. It's a lot of outside influence that's trying to move this bill in Wisconsin.
Well, you mentioned that they would expect some opposition to this. What do you plan to do in this short time span to speak out against the law to try, if possible, to block the passage of it?
Well, we see our role as number one. That's taking you for an opportunity to make our point heard here. But we really want to try to get the word out about what this bill does, the process by which they're doing it. We want to set a framework up and a vehicle for people to be able to express their opinion, participate in democracy, and have a chance to talk to legislators and let them know how they object to this bill. So that's what we're trying to do. Obviously, it's more difficult when they have special rules like this in a very limited time frame, but that's why they're doing it, because they don't want people to understand what's going on here.
Now, the majority of Wisconsin residents are not union members. Maybe they look at this and say, no big deal. This doesn't affect me, doesn't affect that many people. What would your message to them be?
Well, it does affect them. They may not be in a union, but their wages and their benefits are tied to how union jobs go. So the more downward pressure there is on us, the more downward pressure there is on them. So this does affect every one of them. You can look at the studies that show and tie the decline in wages and benefits to the decline in unions. That's not just by chance. That's by design. So if somebody believes that this doesn't affect them because they're not in a union, they're just, mistaken, and they need to educate themselves about what's going on here.
Now, in a poll from the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, a think tank generally regarded as conservative, they had a commissioned a poll from a University of Chicago political science professor. The findings, 62% of Wisconsinites say they would approve of, they'd vote for this kind of right-to-work legislation. So is this something that's in accord with what the people of the state want?
No, absolutely not. What happens with these polls is it all depends how you ask the question. So when you look at this issue, if you say, do you believe people should have the right to work, people are going to say, of course. But as you start to drill down and explain to people what it really means, how it can be used as a wedge to take rights away from people, how it's going to put downward wages on benefits and downward pressure on wages and how it can affect them negatively, you'll see their opinions change on that quickly. So, it just depends how you ask the poll. Most of those polls that have that kind of statistical edge are generally something that they call push polls, where they try to move people towards a certain opinion.
So this is probably going to become law, it looks like, from all signs in the legislature and from the governor. So what is next then for the AFL-CIO and other unions in Wisconsin once this right-to-work law hypothetically is in place?
Well, we continue to educate people. We continue to organize. We continue to try to provide a vehicle for people to have a voice in their workplace, a stronger voice in their community. We continue to reach out and work with other like-minded organizations. Look at what's happened to Wisconsin in terms of the attacks that have come from the outside with the dollars and outside organizations and where it's taken the state of Wisconsin. We don't believe it's taken it in a good direction. So we're going to do everything we can to organize and provide that opportunity for people to participate and to provide an opportunity for people to have a voice in their workplace.
Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Phil Neuenfeld. He's president of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO. We've been talking about right-to-work legislation in Wisconsin. That's going to be debated in the Senate on Wednesday after going through a committee tomorrow. Could pass the legislature in the next couple of weeks. You can continue the conversation at the Central Time Facebook page. We take a look at a new investigative report on teen sexting in Wisconsin. In November, one nude photo from Rhinelander High School led law enforcement officials to dozens of students who were trading explicit pictures with each other on a regular basis.
Shireen Seward is with us to talk about her investigation into teen sexting in Wisconsin. She's a reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. Shireen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, just to make sure we're all on the same page, what is sexting?
Sexting basically is sending a sexually explicit message through a cell phone or a tablet to one another. So, and teens are doing that on an increasing basis.
When you talk about an increasing basis, what are the numbers? How many teens are doing this?
Well, the most recent figures that I found, the most recent survey was done by the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. It was a very widespread survey. Nationwide, nearly 40% of students said that they had either sent or received a sexually explicit image. And now those images are not just staying with their boyfriend or with their girlfriend, but police are telling us that those images are now finding their way into the hands of sexual predators.
And one thing a lot of teens who engage in sexting don't know is that it's actually against the law.
That's right. And they think it's harmless. It seems harmless to them. You know, they're sending a picture of themselves to a boyfriend or to a girlfriend. They have no idea that that picture could be circulated or forwarded or end up, you know, God only knows, you know, 10 or 15 years down the road, something that their own child finds on the internet. And that does happen. It certainly is illegal. Possession of child pornography is, you know, having that image of anyone who is under 18.
Now, to focus in on Rhinelander here in Wisconsin, there was an issue community-wide that came to the attention of law enforcement there. What happened?
Well, it's my understanding that one student had an image on his phone, showed his mom. His mom went to authorities, and that launched the investigation. When the Oneida County Sheriff's Department got involved, they took a look, and they were pretty overwhelmed with the number of kids that were involved. They stopped after identifying more than 40 students. There were hundreds of photos. Some of them ended up as much as five states away. It was just enormous. And when they talked to these kids, they found out that, you know, most of these photos, they were selfies. They were the private photos that were taken. And most of these kids were just doing it without thinking that there was anything potentially wrong with it, that there were any potential consequences to them. It was just something they did, and they did it all the time. So officials decided there, instead of prosecuting, they wanted to educate the kids on what possibly could happen to them.
And some of these photos, I mean, you talk about consequences. Some of that is what you mentioned, the embarrassment factor, the fact that these pictures linger far beyond what anyone might conceive of when you take them on the internet, well into, you know, maybe adulthood. You're looking for a job and that kind of thing. But there are also personal safety things that have become an issue, too. What sorts of things do kids who take these pictures need to be aware of in terms of their own personal risk?
Sure. Some sexual predators are using these nude images to blackmail teens and to producing more pornography of themselves. Some of them are using them to meet in person. There are cases like that that I can name from in Wisconsin and out of Wisconsin where that has happened. Some predators persuade children to trade images of themselves posing as children themselves. They have no idea that they're talking to a 50-year-old man or somebody like that. They think that they're talking to a 15-year-old on the other end of the camera, and that's just not the case. So they can be tricked. They can be persuaded, and some terrible things have happened as a result.
You mentioned education as being the primary tool that law enforcement is leaning toward now. What is the message that needs to get out there?
Well, I've heard from several investigators that I've spoken to that said, you know, it's really hard to stop this behavior, but the best thing that we can do is educate kids as to what can possibly happen. I'm a mother of teenagers myself. I know how they think. They don't think about the potential consequences of their actions. And if they know, they might think twice about sending that button, sending that image or forwarding that image. So they need to know that not only can those photos be around forever, but that it can also lead to some serious consequences legally for them.
Right. We were talking about the legal aspect of this. What are some of the repercussions legally that a kid who's been sexting could face?
Sure. Teens in several states, including Wisconsin, have been charged with felonies, including sexual abuse of a minor and distributing or possessing child pornography for sexting, even when the nude images are traded with other teens. And in 2012, Wisconsin lawmakers passed into law a mandatory minimum 3-year prison sentence for possessing child pornography. So that means a 17-year-old who receives explicit images from a younger friend could be sent to prison. It could happen.
In terms of the technology that's making all this possible, what's changed there?
Well, of course, technology has evolved in the past few decades. There are more apps. Some apps for phones promise anonymity to its users. There are several apps like that. Whisper is one. Another one, Instagram. I mean, you upload those pictures and you can communicate with people anonymously, but the reality is they can get your information, and you don't know who you're talking to. So technology has certainly contributed to the problem.
Is there a way for parents to monitor that kind of activity, short of, you know, sneaking on and checking their kids' phones?
Well, they do need to check browsing history and search for those images on. I know that some parents have an iCloud account where photos that are uploaded from connected iPhones in the account, those images will all go to a central account, and you'll see those pictures that your kids are taking. But really, you've got to talk to your kids more than anything. Be a good parent. Be an involved parent. Talk about this and have this conversation that could be it could be a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, nobody wants to talk about sexually explicit images with their kids, but that's the best thing that you can do. We do have a chat coming up Tuesday night online where three detectives will be giving advice for parents, talking to them about how they can talk to their kids to help protect them.
Do you think that some of the rise in sexting is simply because this technology is so new that as kids do get more educated, there are more conversations like the one you just mentioned, kids become aware of the legal ramifications, that there's going to be a decline in this? Or is there just sort of a kids will be kids aspect to all of it?
Of course, kids will always be kids. Kids will always want to flirt. They'll always want to push the envelope. They're always going to be curious about these kinds of things. But I think it's really important that as children have more access to technology, that parents monitor that technology and they have conversations with their children about what they're doing online.
And as far as law enforcement here in Wisconsin, are they offering any particular advice to students in schools?
You know, really, the biggest advice that they're giving to students is do not send that picture, because that picture that you think is going to stay private is not always staying private. Even on applications like Snapchat, where that image disappears, it doesn't always disappear. Sometimes it stays, there's a digital imprint that stays. Sometimes the person that you send the Snapchat to will take a screenshot of the image you sent and pass that around. So you just never know. And the best thing to do is to not send that picture.
And in Rhinelander, what has been the aftermath of some of what the police uncovered? I know they began and thought they were just kind of getting at the tip of the iceberg. So what's happened in that particular community?
I know that they feel pretty confident that they've at least opened the door to conversation and let parents know what's going on. I think a lot of parents were really shocked to learn that their kids were involved in this kind of behavior. They did have an educational session. They had a special agent come and talk to parents and kids about what could happen. And that's encouraged an ongoing conversation there. So, you know, they feel like they have at least started the process to get a handle on it.
And is that community, do you think, typical of Wisconsin as a whole and maybe the country as a whole?
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. I think that parents largely think that they know what their kids are doing online and on their phones. And I think that they don't. They just don't. I have to say myself, I'm always surprised when I learn these things, too. And as I said, I'm a parent of teenagers, too. So it does hit home for me as well.
A lot of the times, the top-down approach, law enforcement, parents, those kinds of conversations read as sort of authority talking to kids, a bit of a power imbalance that can make the message get lost. Are there any signs that kids themselves could be part of this and urge other kids not to do this?
Well, it sure would be great. And I think that in Rhinelander, for instance, those kids did have some consequences to their behavior. Some were athletes. They were subject to some penalties based on athletic code violations. I mean, they saw some consequences. They certainly weren't charged, you know, with a crime. But those kids, I'm hoping, will be an example for others and will be able to talk to other kids about what not to do so they don't end up in the same situation.
Well, Shireen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I do appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Shireen Seewert, reporter for the Gannett Wisconsin Media Investigative Team, talking about the problem of teen sexting here in Wisconsin.
You can read her reporting over at the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a link there.
Over the past 4 years, frac sand companies in Trempealeau County have begun using a legal maneuver called annexation to avoid strict county regulations. By convincing cities to stretch their boundaries around mines, companies can work directly with city officials to rewrite the rules. But as Rich Kramer reports, a lawsuit brought by two towns could limit future frac sand annexations.
Five frac sand companies have had their properties annexed by nearby cities in Trempealeau County. By convincing city councils to wrap their borders around the mines, companies get a new set of rules, often letting them process and ship sand nonstop, something the county doesn't allow. Trempealeau County Land Management Director Kevin Leon says the county relaxed certain regulations, but the annexations kept coming.
I think they felt that the easiest route is annexation, and it's kind of become a pay-for-play scenario, that if you're willing to pay enough money, you're going to be able to play in the game.
Last spring, Texas-based Superior Silica Sands offered the City of Independence 15 cents per ton of finished sand if they annexed a proposed 550-acre mine. That could work out to more than $100,000 per year for a city of 1,300 people. Mayor Robert Becker says that could fix roads and other infrastructure.
It would help us make those improvements. You could make improvements in the city and not put any tax burden on the taxpayers.
But there's a catch. The proposed mine is more than a mile and a half from the city, and to stretch their boundary that far, Independence needed to annex a strip of land through the towns of Burnside and Lincoln. In most cases, towns can't challenge an annexation, but in 2011, a new law allowed them to ask for a review by the State Department of Administration. If DOA says the annexation appears incontiguous, meaning the property doesn't touch the city, towns can sue to overturn it. Lincoln Town Board Chair Jack Spierstra says he asked the City of Independence to reconsider before contacting the state.
So we warned them that this is what we're going to do, and they said, okay, go ahead, and we did, and the DOA said that, yeah, we probably have a case against them in terms of illegal, incontiguous annexation.
This opened the door for Lincoln and Burnside to sue, and after weeks of deliberations, they went to court. But lawsuits can be expensive, and Spierstra says Superior Silica is paying legal fees for the City of Independence.
You know, you have Independence making decisions knowing that it's not going to cost them anything. And we're making decisions knowing that we could full well pay our full share, and if we lose, pay their full share.
Spierstra says he's not anti-sand. His issue is that residents living next to the proposed mine wouldn't have any say over how it's regulated by the city. That's something Bill Silla can relate to. He lives next to a frac sand mine that was annexed by another city.
You try to say something to the city, and they're like, well, you're not in the city, so we won't do nothing for you. You try to say something to the township or to the county, and they're like, well, that's in the city. There's nothing we can do for you.
Silla now lives with bright lights at night and a constant rumbling he can feel in his bed. He's been following the lawsuit between the towns and the city, and hopes it sets an example.
And if the two townships can beat that annexation, then they would, if they want to keep mining there, they would have to follow the county rules. And then that might set precedence for other mining companies trying to come.
Last week, the town signed an agreement to drop the lawsuit if the City of Independence stops future mine annexations for 20 years. Despite the settlement, a group of citizens living near the site have vowed to keep fighting to overturn the annexation of the proposed Superior Silica Sands mine. The company didn't respond to requests for comment on this story. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
More than half of public school students in the U.S. are considered poor. That's according to a report issued earlier this year by the Southern Education Foundation.
Here in Wisconsin, 41% of public school children are part of low-income families. For our next guest, that means it's more important than ever to equip new teachers with the skills to truly understand the needs of their students.
Joining us now is Jennifer Adair, a professor of early childhood education at the University of Texas, Austin. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Eric Ruiz-Bibee, a doctoral candidate and instructor in the Cultural Studies and Education program there at the University of Texas, Austin. He's also a former New York City public school teacher. Eric, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jennifer, let's start with you. When we talk about the statistic, over half of public school students facing poverty from low-income families, what does that mean to you in terms of training teachers to enter the classroom?
Well, I think, first of all, it means that I think sometimes when students go into the classroom and they see or they're with families who are kind of in financial stress, they tend to make negative assumptions about those families or about those kids. And they kind of make assumptions about how much instruction they can give them, how involved their parents will be. And I think our job as teacher educators is to help them see the assets that those children and families bring to school with them. And also give them a lot of tools to engage and help the children value the communities and families that they have.
And Eric, this may not be news to you. You worked, I gather, in a Brooklyn school where 96% of students qualified for free or reduced lunch. How did your experience there change the way you approach teaching?
Yeah, so actually I taught summer school in Brooklyn, and then in Washington Heights is where I mm-hmm. taught for 4 years. But yeah, the relatively high rate of poverty at my school definitely influenced the approach in the classroom. I mean, it really made getting out into the community and getting to know kind of my students' lives and their families that much more important to understand how to meet their needs in the classroom.
So Jennifer, that sounds like a tall order for training a teacher. You're not just training them for the school day. You're saying, as a teacher, you're kind of you have to be out in the community beyond, you know, after the school bell rings and you're off hours. Is that asking a lot of teachers?
It is asking a lot of teachers, but I actually don't think it all has to take place outside of school hours, because I think there's a lot of things that we at the University of Texas, we try to help our training of teachers. We kind of work with them to get to know the community even in the school day. So, for example, we have all of our pre-service teachers meet with parents. If they can't do it during the day, then obviously they have to do it after school, but they try hard to meet with parents and interview them about their kids and find out about their kids' lives and kind of position the parents as being experts on their kids. And every time, I'm not kidding, every time we have the students do this, in their reflection papers, they are always stunned by how much they learn about the kids by interviewing the parents and how much insight the parents give them into the kids' lives, and then how they can create curriculum that connects to the children's lives or helps the children see like the beauty and the value even in a difficult situation. So I think that's something important that we help teachers do. And there's other things like we teach our students how to involve parents and community into their lesson plans for the day. So if they're doing project-based learning and they have experts that need to come in and tell the kids about how to care for a pet or how to build a structure, they can look to the children's own community and the children's own families and have them come in and be experts even in the school day to kind of add value to where the children are coming from, no matter what their financial situation is.
Eric, Jennifer earlier mentioned sometimes teachers come in with mistaken assumptions about what the capabilities are going to be of a children from a low-income family, assumptions about their families too. In your teaching career, did you have those mistaken assumptions? How did you work through them?
Absolutely, yeah. So I actually entered teaching through an alternative certification program called Teach for America that provides teachers with about 5 weeks of summer training. And so I struggled a lot when I during my first couple years in the classroom, and actually depended a lot on really experienced women of color colleagues at my school to kind of, again, help me get over that hurdle. One of the things that we ended up doing at my school was eventually writing a grant to do community sustainability projects that took us out in the community with the students to examine everything from green spaces, you know, where they're able to play after school, you know, to the amount of, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables that were at the corner bodegas, which are the kind of the combination deli and supermarkets that are really common in New York. Those are just some of the things that really helped me to kind of better comprehend the reality of my students and therefore better meet their needs in the classroom.
Jennifer, these things sound nice. They sound like creative ways to approach teaching of low-income students. Is there really a payoff, though? Do we know that these things really make a difference when it comes to the educational outcome, maybe the life outcome for the students we're talking about?
Sure. Well, we do know some things about what tends to not happen. So we know there's a lot of really nice work being done around project-based learning and about the access to creative or inquiry-based learning. And what we are finding is that in low-income schools where there's a lot of pressure to pass standardized exams and there's a lot of panic that students won't be passing them, and that affects the financial and stability of the school itself, that a lot of students who are low-income are denied access to a lot of creative and critical thinking kinds of learning experiences. So they don't get to do projects. They don't get to do kind of creative thinking work. They don't get to follow their interests or their passions. They sit for long periods of time. And they don't get to do kind of the rigorous learning experiences that we would all want for our own children. So what tends to happen is being poor is an excuse to deny children certain kinds of learning experiences. And we kind of see that over and over across states that happens. And so part of training teachers is to train them in to do this kind of rigorous teaching where students have really sophisticated kinds of learning experiences, and they're not just sitting and doing worksheets, but they're creating projects, they're working collaboratively, they're engaging with the community, they're thinking critically, they're involved in lots of STEAM kinds of activities. But at the same time, the teachers can be sensitive to the difficult situation they and their parents are in. So it's kind of that dual mentality of being sensitive to a lot of financial stress that the kids might be bringing, and it might affect kind of the way they're concentrating, the way they enter the classroom, along with the right that kids have to have really engaging, exciting kinds of learning experiences no matter what their financial situation is.
We're talking with Jennifer Adair and Eric Ruiz-Bibee, both of the University of Texas Austin, talking about how to teach teachers who are likely to go on to work with low-income students, largely in public schools.
And teachers, we want to hear from you now. With 41% of Wisconsin's public school students facing poverty, we want to know if some of what you're hearing rings true in your classroom, or if you're a parent struggling to provide the same opportunities to your child as other parents. We'd like to hear from you as well. You can share your questions and your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking about how to equip public school teachers with the skills needed to work with children living in poverty. A recent report says that over half of American public school children are from low-income families.
We're talking with Jennifer Adair and Eric Ruiz-Bibee of the University of Texas Austin, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How do you think teachers can better work with low-income students and their families and their communities? What does it take to ensure that all kids get equal opportunities in our public schools? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@wpr.org. Go to a caller. We've got Miranda on the line in South Milwaukee. Miranda, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just wanted to bring up kind of the barriers that teachers face in Wisconsin. I'm a fully certified teacher who just moved here from Canada. Immigrated, have my green card, have my social security number and everything else. I have 3 years of teaching experience working in a high needs area in northern Canada where the poverty rate is over 80%. And I would love to teach here, but they make it so difficult for teachers to get certified from other countries. They're missing out on a lot of highly skilled people.
Interesting, Miranda. Thanks for that call. Jennifer, is there a need to cast a wider net, make it easier for more people from different backgrounds, in this case from another country, to do this kind of teaching?
I think that we definitely have a recruitment issue where a lot of the teachers that we have don't necessarily come from the same communities or face some of the same issues as the students they're teaching. So, for example, the majority of teachers, like over 80% of the teachers, are white, and that definitely doesn't reflect the kids in public schools in the U.S. And so that's been kind of an issue in teacher education throughout the country, is this inability to recruit recruit teacher education students who reflect the students in public school. But I do think we have a pipeline issue for sure, and the caller brings up a good point.
Miranda, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Linda in Madison. Linda, hi.
Yes. I've worked mostly in the early childhood and early elementary school, and the thing that I've noticed mostly from the transportation end is these families have a very hard time sticking to expected routines, such as making sure the kids are at the bus stop when the bus pulls up, especially this time of year. May not have enough clothes, so they'll wait to the last minute to leave the house. A lot of times it's the oldest sibling trying to get themselves ready, plus everybody else. They're hungry, they're sleepy.
Linda, thanks a lot. I want to get our guests in because we're a little short on time now. Eric, is that a challenge for teachers? Sometimes kids are coming in without what we might consider the basics. They're hungry, they don't have appropriate clothes for the season, and so on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think this really gets back to what Dr. Dare was talking about earlier, is that the teaching requires complex thinking, right? This notion that you have to be able to hold in the very real challenges that your students face in your mind while at the same time recognizing the assets that they bring to the classroom. And a really good example, I think, was brought up by the caller when she mentioned this notion of kids having to get younger siblings ready for school, right, and how that kind of can have an impact in the classroom. I think one way of looking at that that focuses on deficit would be to maybe to feel sorry for those kids or to only look at the way that negatively impacts them. But I think what we need to do is kind of flip the script in teacher education and really think about how that can also be an asset, right, that kids who grow up caring for your younger siblings, that they have skills that may be transferred to the classroom, right? Responsibility, teamwork, leadership skills, and we need to think about how to use those as well.
Linda,
if I could add something. There's a tremendous professor at Madison, actually. His name's Travis Wright. He's an early childhood professor, and he's doing a project with homeless young children in Madison. There's about 1,300 homeless students, and I think almost half of them are under six and just beginning their schooling experience. And the one thing that he's written about is that we don't ask the parents or the kids what their experience is. We assume what it is, we assume what it means, but we don't ask them how they feel about school or what would help them to be more successful in school or how they feel about their teachers. So I think there's actually a lot of research and understanding even that we don't have about people who are going through real financial stress and what we might be able to do better in the schooling system for them.
And with all of this, Eric, these all sound like great things, but is there time? I mean, you're trying to teach the lessons. You're maybe trying to figure out if students had enough food. You're trying to have this bring the family into the school day. Is this just too much to ask of a teacher with a finite chunk of time and resources to work with?
Well, I mean, it is a lot to ask, and it's very, very challenging. I can say from personal experience working in these kinds of communities, high-need communities, and also kind of sustaining of family life and things like that. I think one thing that we can do is not do things that are not productive during the school day. And I think our experience with No Child Left Behind over the past, you know, 14 years that we've had it is that it really eats into a lot of the time that the teachers have to be doing more meaningful things, like getting to know their students, like bringing in, as Dr. Dare mentioned, you know, parents to be experts. So I think, you know, in thinking about how to approach this, one thing that we can do is, and this is currently being debated right now in Congress, is to de-emphasize these standardized tests, which have really been abused over the course of the last 14 years.
I want to wrap up with an email from Jennifer in Elgin. She writes, today my at-risk fifth graders finished creating the four layers of the rainforest in my room. They drew, painted, cut out, wrote haikus and fact boxes, doing the same readings as the assigned module, but these readings have come to life. Creativity and freedom, she says, for students is key. Jennifer, true for low-income students, that's a key to get that into the classrooms as we wrap up?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, we're in an idea-based economy, and if these kids are going to be able to change their situation financially as they get older, they're going to need all of these critical thinking, problem-solving opportunities. And if we deny them those, then we really deny them the opportunity to change their situation as they get older.
Thanks to both of you for joining us today. We've been talking to Jennifer Adair, professor of early childhood education at the University of Texas, Austin, and Eric Ruiz-Bibee, a doctoral candidate and instructor in the Cultural Studies and Education program at the University of Texas, Austin, also a former New York City public school teacher. Thirty-five years ago yesterday, the U.S. men's Olympic hockey team pulled off one of the most legendary upsets in sports history at the 1980 Winter Olympics. Here's sportscaster Al Michaels calling the game's triumphant final seconds.
The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
And wow, still exciting today. Forever known as the Miracle on Ice, the U.S. team defeated the heavily favored Soviet Union team, which had won gold medals in six of the last seven Olympic Games.
That 1980 U.S. team had strong Wisconsin connections. Along with fellow Madison native Bob Suter was Mark Johnson, who's currently the head coach of the UW women's hockey team.
Johnson scored two goals in the historic matchup, including one that tied the game in the last second of the first period.
Shocking the sports world, building on their stunning victory, Team USA went on to win the gold medal in the following game with a 4-2 win over Finland.
The Miracle on Ice was declared the greatest sports moment of the 20th century by Sports Illustrated.
I do remember, or at least my memory tells me, I remember watching the end of that game, though I've heard those final moments a bunch of times since then.
Right, and I remember everyone in my family suddenly becoming diehard hockey fans where they never had cared before. It's pretty cool.